Namaste. So, we're in the middle of the 19th chapter in Essays on the Gita, first series, with the chapter Equality, a subject that is of enormous importance, not only to the understanding of the Gita's teaching, but to Sri Aurobindo's ascent towards an integral yoga. Equality, samatha, samatva, if you prefer, is the essential spiritual condition, the thing by which one can measure whether there has been inward success or not in the practice of the yoga. However much the senses or the outer personality may be startled by events or suffer depression, confusion, whatever that may be, if inwardly one is always composed, never loses one's asana, but is always seated in the soul, that is a sign of equality. Being equal to things that buffet us physically, emotionally, intellectually, mentally, and being unmoved within, that is a spiritual state. Also note that Sri Aurobindo is making very clear here that it is the active poise in life in which we have to attain equality. It's not just Sri Aurobindo, the Gita is doing this. The Gita arises two or three centuries before the Common Era begins, and in the face of two strong Shramanic traditions that were gaining strength in India, Jainism and Buddhism, which had the impact of drawing one's attention away from the virtues and the rewards of life and towards an isolated renunciation. Indeed, both Jainism and Buddhism aim at the conquest of desire and ego, and that is in itself something that the Gita also endeavors to attain. But the Gita aims at constructively building a spiritual life. This Shramanic tradition has been a weight. It has its own innings in the West, of course, in the monastic traditions of Christianity. But the Gita, a couple of thousand years ago, is a historical response to call the soul of India back to life, to a life of the spirit, and not a rejection of life. Now, let's say 2,500 years later, Sri Aurobindo reasserts the same thing. He brings us to a proper and balanced view of what the Gita's teaching is and enjoins upon us in his own yoga some of the same verities that we find in the Gita. We must live from within, from a spiritual consciousness, housed in the self, seated in the soul, and make life a field of our yogic activities. Yoga that takes us up into union with the Supreme, a yoga that then continues by bringing light and energy down and investing it in this world. Of course, along the way, one has to note that one who lives in this consciousness has no need of acquiring great wealth or fame, all the things which are lures to the outer personality. Instead, such a one lives sovereignly from inside, satisfied with simple things, realizing that it is only the divine who is everywhere and who is the ultimate possessor of all. Well, anyway, I've said enough. So Sri Aurobindo is into the first part of what we were reading last week with this sentence: the joy of the soul in the dualities is the secret of the mind's pleasure in living. Yes, when we live in the outward or the frontal parts of our being, what has called us here, in a sense, to evolve and grow and develop are the very things which become later our prison house. So we must leave it behind at some point. So we'll take it up from here. And he's talking about the Rajasic desire soul in this section. Ask it to rise out of all this disturbance to the unmingled joy of the pure bliss soul, which all the time secretly supports its strength in the struggle and makes its own continued existence possible. It will draw back at once from the call. It does not believe in such an existence, or it believes there would not be life, that it would not be at all the varied existence in the world around it in which it is accustomed to take pleasure. It would be something tasteless and without savor. This is, after all, the Rajasic desire soul. Or it feels that the effort would be too difficult for it. It recoils from the struggle of the ascent, although in reality the spiritual change is not at all more difficult than the realization of the dreams the desire soul pursues, nor entails more struggle and labor in the attainment than the tremendous effort which the desire soul expends in its passionate chase after its own transient objects of pleasure and desire. Yes, actually, one might, even if a little slothful, achieve a realization in two or three decades of earnest work, and I don't know who's been able to fulfill their vital dreams in such a short compass, unless it's a trick of nature and a bit of luck, simply to keep you interested in the dazzling possibilities of the game. The true cause of its unwillingness is that it is asked to rise above its own atmosphere and breathe a rarer and purer air of life, whose bliss and power it cannot realize and hardly ever conceives as real, while the joy of this lower turbid nature is to it the one thing familiar and palpable. Nor is this lower satisfaction in itself a thing evil and unprofitable. It is rather the condition for the upward evolution of our human nature out of the tamasic ignorance and inertia to which its material being is most subject. It is the Rajasic stage of the graded ascent of man towards the supreme self-knowledge, power, and bliss. But if we rest eternally on this plane, the Madhyama Gatihi of the Gita, our ascent remains unfinished, the evolution of the soul incomplete. And we might translate that bit of Sanskrit as the middle path or a middle station, meaning that it's a plateau. If it's an ascent, if we're climbing a mountain, we have to continue to climb after all, or we don't get to the peak. We don't summit. Through the sattvic being in nature, to that which is beyond the three gunas, lies the way of the soul to its perfection. Continue to climb. The movement which will lead us out of the disturbances of the lower nature must be necessarily a movement towards equality in the mind, in the emotional temperament, in the soul. But it is to be noted that although in the end we must arrive at a superiority to all the three gunas of the lower nature, it is yet in its incipience, by a resort to one or the other of the three, that the movement must begin. Ah, equality at any of these levels of the gunas. The beginning of equality may be sattvic, rajasic, or tamasic, for there is a possibility in the human nature of a tamasic equality. It may be purely tamasic, the heavy equability of a vital temperament rendered inertly irresponsive to the shocks of existence by a sort of dull insensibility undesirous of the joy of life. Standing in the center of the ring, you can't knock him down. He doesn't feel your blows. Or it may result from a weariness of the emotions and desires accumulated by a surfeit and satiety of the pleasure, or else on the contrary, a disappointment and a disgust and shrinking from the pain of life, a lassitude of fear and horror and dislike of the world. It is then in its nature a mixed movement, rajaso-tamasic, but the lower quality predominates. And this sounds very like what we typically interpret vairagya to be. The motive to leave the world, it is a disgusting place, I'm throwing it down, I won't stain my hands with it any longer. I'm going to march off and renounce self and family and responsibility and world, and I'm going to sit in the forest and I'm going to realize the divine, apart from all, alone, in solitude. That is not the renunciation which the Gita would lead us to. But that is typical of the lower urge, or a first movement towards what would become equality, samatha or samatva. Or approaching the sattvic principle, it may aid itself by the intellectual perception that the desires of life cannot be satisfied, that the soul is too weak to master life, that the whole thing is nothing but sorrow and transient effort, and nowhere in it is there any real truth or sanity or light or happiness. This is the sattva-tamasic principle of equality, and is not so much equality, though it may lead to that, as indifference or equal refusal. Essentially, the movement of tamasic equality is a generalization of nature's principle of jugupsa, or self-protecting recoil, extended from the shunning of particular painful effects to a shunning of the whole life of nature itself, as in sum leading to pain and self-tormenting, and not to the delight which the soul demands. As if atmarattihi, the rolling pleasure of the self in itself, is only possible away from the world. The self-realized soul, as we see in the Taittiriya Upanishad, wanders through the world from one event, one incident, one plane of existence to another, ever wrapped in ananda. In Tamasic Equality by itself, there is no real liberation, but it can be made a powerful starting point if, as in Indian asceticism, it is turned into the sattvic by the perception of the greater existence, the truer power, the higher delight of the immutable self above nature. The natural turn of such a movement, however, is towards sannyasa, the renunciation of life and works, rather than to that union of inner renunciation of desire with continued activity in the world of nature, which the Gita advocates. Okay, sannyasa on one side, tyaga on the other. The outer renunciation versus the inner renunciation, which actually leads to release from chasing the objects of the senses. Without the latter, the former doesn't work anyway. The Gita, however, admits and makes room for this movement. It allows, as a recoiling starting point, the perception of the defects of the world existence, birth and disease and death and old age and sorrow, the historic starting point of the Buddha. Janma mrityu jara vyadhi dukkha dosha anudarshanam. That's 13:8. And it accepts the effort of those whose self-discipline is motivated by a desire for release, even in this spirit, from the curse of age and death. Jara marana mokshaya mam ashritya yatanti ye. And that's 7:29. So in other words, whatever starts us in a spiritual direction is welcome. From whatever plane, we'll take it. We'll begin with that and we'll go from there. So indeed, you can begin where you are. You need no further preparation. You need to undertake no lustratory rites. You don't have to seek initiatory permission. Begin living spiritually, even here, even now. The tamasic unwillingness to accept the pain and effort of life is indeed by itself a weakening. Oh, I think I've skipped. Pardon me. Back up. But that, to be of any profit, must be accompanied by the sattvic perception of a higher state and the taking delight and refuge in the existence of the divine. Mam ashritya, my refuge. Then the soul, by its recoil, comes to a greater condition of being, lifted beyond the three gunas and free from birth and death and age and grief, and enjoys the immortality of its self-existence. Janma mrityu jara dukhair vimukto amritam ashnute. That's 14:20. The tamasic unwillingness to accept the pain and effort of life is indeed by itself a weakening and degrading thing. And in this lies the danger of preaching to all alike the gospel of asceticism and world disgust, that it puts the stamp of a tamasic weakness and shrinking on unfit souls, confuses their understanding. Buddhi bedam janayet, 3:26. Diminishes the sustained aspiration, the confidence in living, the power of effort which the soul of man needs for its salutary, its necessary rajasic struggle to master its environment without really opening to it. For it is yet incapable of that, a higher goal, a greater endeavor, a mightier victory. Now, you remember back in the scene where we meet Arjuna and Krishna, that Krishna immediately asks Arjuna to pick up the bow and fight and do it for the values that are dear to him, because that's his real nature. It would be a weakening and a retrogressive movement for Arjuna to fail the test of the moment. He wouldn't be following his own nature, and he'd be moving away from the world, although that's not the argument that the Gita makes at that moment. Here, though, we see from Sri Aurobindo's interpretation the impact if we race all of us into the caves, renounce the world is left bereft of its most aspiring and perhaps most illumined souls, or those which most aspire to bring something higher down. We need our souls here, working on this earth. And in us personally, it digs a groove which wants to repeat itself again and again. Renounce and walk away once, that wants to become a habit and wants to reassert itself. And this obtains also on a societal level, that failing to capture the need of the moment, missing the import given to us by the time spirit, Kala, we flinch. We don't see what we need to do. We don't recognize it utterly. And we're sensorially challenged by the need, by the demand. But we must do this. And we can't let the collective sink just as we can't let the individual sink. We have to shore each other up. And words luminous and powerful as these, which the Gita and Sri Aurobindo in his interpretation offer us, we need to return to from time to time, to help us remember who we are and to right our course of action. A higher goal, a greater endeavor, a mightier victory. But in souls that are fit, this tamasic recoil may serve a useful spiritual purpose by slaying their rajasic attraction, their eager preoccupation with the lower life, which prevents the sattvic awakening to a higher possibility. Seeking, then, for a refuge in the void they have created, they are able to hear the divine call. O soul, that findest thyself in this transient and unhappy world, turn and put thy delight in me, anityam asukam lokam, imam prapya bhajasvamam. That's 9:33. Yes, but that's for the person that needs to hear that song at that time. That is not for everyone. Still, in this movement, the equality consists only in an equal recoil from all that constitutes the world, and it arrives at an indifference and aloofness, but does not include that power to accept equally all the touches of the world, pleasurable or painful, without attachment or disturbance, which is a necessary element in the discipline of the Gita. Therefore, even if we begin with the tamasic recoil, which is not at all necessary, it can only be a first incitement to a greater endeavor, not as a permanent pessimism. The real discipline begins with the movement to mastery over these things, from which we were first inclined merely to flee. It is here that the possibility of a kind of rajasic equality comes in, which is, at its lowest, the strong nature's pride and self-mastery, self-control, superiority to passion and weakness. But the Stoic ideal seizes upon this point of departure and makes it the key to an entire liberation of the soul from subjection to all weakness of its lower nature. So again, Stoicism was not merely strength and self-denial, but it was penned upon this idea of seeing things with a certain resignation, with a certain distance, a philosophic freedom from attachment. As the Thomistic inward recoil is a generalization of nature's principle of jugupsa, or self-protection from suffering, so the rajasic upward movement is a generalization of nature's other principle of the acceptance of struggle and effort and the innate impulse of life towards mastery and victory. But it transfers the battle to the field where alone complete victory is possible. So instead of walking away or running away, the Stoic heroic attitude walks straight into it. As if its motto is, the best way out of difficulty is through it. Instead of a struggle for scattered outward aims and transient successes, it proposes nothing less than the conquest of nature and the world itself by a spiritual struggle and an inner victory. The Thomistic recoil turns from both the pains and pleasures of the world to flee from them. The Rajasic movement turns upon them to bear, master, and rise superior to them. The Stoic self-discipline calls desire and passion into its embrace of the wrestler and crushes them between its arms, as did old Dhritarashtra in the epic The Iron Image of Bhima. If you're familiar with this, this is at towards the end of the Mahabharata, when this father of the 100 evil sons, you know, who's blind, not only symbolically, but physically too, promises that he won't do any harm to Bhima, who has killed his favorite son, if he comes in and lets him hug him. And so Bhima says, sure, you can hug me, but instead puts this iron image of himself there. And Dhritarashtra, indeed, takes that iron image and hugs it and crushes it to smithereens. And then, realizing what he has done, said, oh, this is against my soul's nature. I'm sorry and I apologize deeply. Bhima, I have embarrassed myself. I have shamed myself. I indeed am sorry. So I don't see a perfect analogy there, except that the Stoic self-discipline will indeed crush its enemy in its arms. It endures the shock of things painful and pleasurable, the causes of the physical and mental affections of the nature, and breaks their effects to pieces. It is complete when the soul can bear all touches without being pained or attracted, excited, or troubled. It seeks to make man the conqueror and king of his nature. Swaraj, self-rule. So, acceptance and resignation leading to strong simplification of life. Well, I think we'll put a bookmark there and finish this chapter next week. Maybe it's a little short in the reading. If you have questions or condemnations that you'd like to send to me, of course, I'll read your emails gladly. I think I will read Savitri now, though. Hopefully to the delight of all, a passage that we'll begin this Sunday and end next. Oh, and by the way, Next Sunday in America, we leave daylight saving time. Goodness knows what we've saved, but we will return to standard time. So, this is in Book One, the Book of Beginnings, in Canto Three, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. Only a while at first, these heavenlier states, these large, wide, poised upliftings could endure. The high and luminous tension breaks too soon. The body's stone stillness and the life's hushed trance, the breathless might and calm of silent mind, or slowly they fail as sets a golden day. The restless nether members tire of peace, a nostalgia of old little works and joys, a need to call back small familiar selves, to tread the accustomed and inferior way, the need to rest in a natural pose of fall, as a child who learns to walk can walk not long. Replace the Titan will forever to climb, on the heart's altar, dim the sacred fire. An old pull of subconscious cords renews. It draws the unwilling spirit from the heights, or a dull gravitation drags us down to the blind driven inertia of our base. This too the supreme diplomat can use. He makes our fall a means for greater rise. For into ignorant nature's gusty field, into the half-ordered chaos of mortal life, the formless power, the self of eternal light, follow in the shadow of the spirit's descent. The twin duality, forever one, chooses its home mid the tumults of the sense. He comes unseen into our darker parts, and curtained by the darkness, does his work, a subtle and all-knowing guest and guide, till they too feel the need and will to change. All here must learn to obey a higher law. Our body's cells must hold the immortal's flame. Else would the spirit reach alone its source, leaving a half-saved world to its dubious fate. Nature would ever labor unredeemed, our earth would ever spin unhelped in space, and this immense creation's purpose fail, till at last the frustrate universe sank undone. Ever, even his godlike strength to rise must fall. His greater consciousness withdrew behind. Dim and eclipsed, his human outside strove to feel again the old sublimities, bring the high saving touch, the ethereal flame, call back to its dire need the divine force. So good to see you, everyone. I hope you're well. Splendors that you are in your soul. Carry it into the world. Let's transform this place, beginning with ourselves, positively impacting our environment, living simply but richly, and always from inside out. So, namaste. Jai Ma.